Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Lori Townsend.
Hello, thanks for joining us. Today we're going to be discussing a series of reports that seek to define the potential changes to public health in rural Alaska communities through the lens of the Alaska's rapidly changing climate. Joining me in the studio is Michael Brubaker. Michael is the director of Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium's Division of Community Health Services. Thank you for being here. Also in the studio is KSKA's newly hired Anchorage reporter, Zachariah Hughes. Zachariah joins us today because of his experience working at KNOM and in Nome and reporting on rural community issues. Thank you also for being here. And then joining us on a video connection from Barrow is Heather Dingman. Heather is the North Slope Borough's Health Impact Assessment Program Coordinator. You both have lengthy titles, but I think we've got them out there. Welcome, everyone. Let's start with why ANTHC and the North Slope Borough are looking at health through the lens of climate change. These community assessments have been conducted over the last 5 years, 2009 to 2014. Point Hope, Wainwright, Atkasuk, and Nuiqsut. Michael, how did this concept get underway?
Yeah, and about 20 other communities as well. But, I mean, most recently we've really begun to understand some of these changes in the North Slope Borough. And what we recognized was that climate change was having environmental impacts all across Alaska, from the North Slope to Southeast to the tip of the Aleutian Chain. And what we wanted to understand is, were these environmental changes affecting community health? And were they positive and were they negative, and how are people adapting to them? Mm-hmm. So specifically, we wanted to understand better how climate change was affecting the potential or types of disease, rates of injury, how it affected people's ability to harvest adequate amounts of safe food, and their ability to also make and produce adequate amounts of safe water, and the infrastructure that's important, both the clinical transportation infrastructure and things like water treatment plants and sewage lagoons. So we were looking at all those things, and then really the backdrop of all of this was mental health. How were people adapting to the changes that were occurring, and was it creating stress, and how was that going? Mm-hmm. So,
very broad assessment. Heather, let's you're in Barrow and from Barrow. Tell us about how people who have made their living from the land and the waters there on the North Slope for generations are considering these changes. Is it a big part of the conversation, or are people just working hard to adapt and adjust?
Yeah, it's a really big part of the conversation, actually, for probably for the last 10 or so years. We've seen, so the five categories of health we've looked at with ANTHC were chronic disease, unintentional injury, mental health, food safety and security, and water safety and security. And those are all issues and concerns we've been talking about up here. People are traveling farther to get the subsistence resources they need. And so that means, more causes for injury. Also, traveling farther, spending more money to get those resources can have an impact on your mental health and well-being. So, spending all that money on subsistence hunting and then not being successful at it because of environmental changes can have a big impact on mental health. Also, the food safety and security issue is a big one. Where we store our subsistence resources is in our sigalocs or ice cellars. They're not as stable as they used to be, and so that brings up the question about foodborne illnesses. And water safety and security, the drinking water sources have an increased temperature over the years, and so that's concerning for our communities.
Well, let's stay with you for a moment, Heather, and look at potentially some of these health impacts that may be directly related, if you've been able to define that, and maybe Michael, you'll want to join in here in a moment. But Heather, are you seeing health impacts that are suspected of a direct link to changes in temperature, to the impacts of climate change? Are there things you mentioned, mental health issues potentially, and also other types of illness or injury? What have you been able to assess, if anything, that you consider directly linked?
Unintentional injuries, for sure. We haven't thoroughly documented the increase in injuries, and so that's something that we're looking into doing, is establishing new survey tools into the data we collect, so that we can capture just how much the injuries are increasing up here because of unintentional injuries from traveling farther for the resources.
All right, Zachariah, I know that you have some questions based on your experience as a reporter in rural Alaska, so I'll turn to you now.
Yeah, well, and I'm going to turn to Michael, because my questions are people in different parts of the state seeing the same effects of climate change from where you guys have looked at? So a community in the Southwest in a place like Levelock, are they seeing the same effects of climate change as people in Nooksit, Wainwright, far up north in the high Arctic, or is it a totally different portrait that you guys are seeing across the state?
Well, Alaska has several different climate zones. I think there's five different climate zones, and some of them join up in the Arctic, like right around Northwest Arctic region. So that's a especially, volatile area for climate change. But, the interior communities have some common types of issues that they see. I think the whole permafrost-rich region of Alaska in the north also have sort of special vulnerabilities to climate change. In those areas on the North Slope and the Northwest Arctic and the Bering Strait region, those are regions of the state and interior that were, typically characterized as being frozen and fairly resilient because it was a frozen landscape. Now these landscapes are in the Arctic, are increasingly warming, and because of that, vulnerable to change. So anywhere where we're seeing, a warming occur and the land thawing, we're very interested in understanding how those communities are responding. Further south, people don't necessarily talk as much, but there are lots of important climate change-related changes occurring. If you go down to southeast, a lot of those communities are very dependent upon snowpack for their water supply, also for providing adequate runoff through the rivers for salmon to spawn and for fish to spawn in. And, in years when we've had less snowpack or a warmer summer, we're seeing communities that have less water in their reservoir. So we have to start thinking about how we manage our water resources more carefully. And there's also been issues with, low water in streams, fish die-offs in streams because there is not as much water and there's not as enough oxygen. And there's issues happening in the ocean environment as well. And on the chain, there's certain issues there with extreme weather, with changes in snow conditions, with having no snow in the wintertime, and how that affects things like berry production. Berries are very sensitive to snow and precipitation conditions. And we're seeing much more variability in people's ability to get the berries they need from years where it's a bumper crop and everyone's doing terrific to a year where there's nothing. And so people are learning to adapt to those changes in resource availability.
And I guess from being across different parts of the state, what for you, as you've worked on these reports, has been the most alarming change? What are the things that you've seen that just totally shocked your expectations when you started doing these reports?
Well, I think one thing is how broad the effects are, that they cross over into all those different categories that Heather and I mentioned. But, we talk a lot about the coastal impacts in these communities that are on the verge of relocation or in the process of relocation. And certainly because of ice change, because of thawing, coastal communities are seeing a lot of really dramatic impacts. What surprised me a little bit was going upriver and seeing, along the river corridors, Communities in the interior, the river communities in the northwest and on the north slope are also seeing really dramatic changes, which is affecting their ability to get from one place to another, their ability to harvest, and their ability to have good, clean resources, for example, for drinking water. The other thing was the movement of species. Invasive species, range change, animals showing up where they've never occurred before. It's really exciting, it's really interesting, and people have a lot of local knowledge to share about that. What it all means kind of depends on the individual. If you're a young person, it might be very exciting, you know, to be the first person that's ever seen, you know, a red fox in your community. For older people, a lot of this is kind of distressing.
You've compiled some dramatic information about the changes in permafrost, studies from starting in 1980, and we've got some of those that we can look at that show the change in how the temperature has actually warmed, especially in the lower part of the state, a pretty dramatic change. I would ask both of you, Michael and Heather, to weigh in here. When we drill down a little bit and look at some of those direct impacts to food resources, what's the most alarming? Is it the storage of meat, or what is emerging as the most current and most immediate need to address as far as food stability and food supplies?
Well, I think my take on that would be, the ability for communities in rural Alaska to exist where they are is largely dependent on the economics of their food resources. And we need to, protect that access in order for communities to continue to be viable. And it's important for commercial and for sport reasons as well. I think what's quite dramatic is that for people who are actively going out, harvesting, preparing, drying, smoking, putting in their ice cellar, and then consuming traditional foods and wild foods, they're seeing new changes and new challenges at every step along the way. So I think people are putting a lot of thought and a lot of innovation into how they go out and get what they need, how they bring it back safely, and then how they can preserve it, and they aren't the way they were in the past.
And Heather, I would ask you a similar question. Are there, when people are drying or smoking meats, both fish and proteins, are they seeing that they have to do things differently? Do they have to change their processes? Or are there molds and other types of environmental hazards that might be stemming from what you're observing there?
Sure. So we're having a wetter season longer. And that means less opportunity to dry the foods. We don't traditionally smoke foods up here, but I've noticed the conversation has been focused towards trying to smoke foods as a way to preserve them when drying them isn't an option because of the wetter season.
And what about the concern about molds? Or I'm wondering if those are some of the vectors that you're concerned about in these studies that may be emerging as concerns for public health.
Well, maybe we could look at the example of a traditional cellar. So people's ability to store large amounts of whale meat and muktuk and other things have for many years been dependent upon having these underground ice storage cellars. And the conditions in those cellars are pretty consistent and cold and not too dry. And because people are able to put it in there and manage the way and when they take it out, they get a certain flavor and a certain quality of product that they really like, and it's quite community specific. What's happening now is, from warming, the cellars are wetter, so becoming, rather than a drier environment, a much wetter environment, and they're warmer. So you're not storing your meat in a freezer condition so much, you're storing in more of a refrigerator condition. And it may get too wet. And so issues about fungus, foodborne illness, the quality of the product, waste, are new types of challenges, or at least bigger types of challenges that are happening with these traditional sellers.
Mm-hmm. And Zach, I know that you had some questions just about the sellers themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think that handles most of what I was curious about, except I was just so taken in the reports on Kivalina and Nooksit about the descriptions of how climate change is having a very real cultural effect. And I'm wondering if you can just say a little bit more about how cultural practice and traditional practices are being altered by changes going on in, you know, the permafrost layer that's affecting these ice sellers. I think you've covered some of it, but how are people adapting? How are they changing? Is it changing how people are preparing their meat? You know, what they're going after, how ceremonies and festivals are prepared for? You know, are people using freezers, more chest freezers and stuff like that, instead of traditional means?
Or are they having to adjust how they actually build the ice cellars themselves? We've seen slumping permafrost that's possibly flooding or moving some of these cellars so that they're not able to be used. Are they having to change a traditional way of building them?
Well, I think I can speak a little bit to the construction and things, and I think Heather has a lot that she can add on this. But, you know, it's, you know, when you talk about preserving food, we mentioned the problems with drying fish or drying seal, and that there are certain conditions that have typically always been present during the spring or in the fall, which are just right for making sure you have a dry, well-preserved product. When it gets too wet, you get problems with spoilage and mold, and then you end up throwing away part of your harvest or giving it to a dog or something. And it's because the climate is getting wetter and warmer, but mostly wetter. With the ice cellars, I think, you know, some of those cellars just have to be abandoned because they're too close to an eroding bank or they're too thawed. And they're just not, and that's what's happening, is there's cellars being abandoned all along coastal northern Alaska. People are also looking for new locations to relocate their cellars. They're trying out different things with, you know, using maybe more conventional type of cooling with walk-in freezers, or, you know, people, a lot of people have large storage freezers. The problem is that you don't get the same product. It's very different storing something in a root cellar and storing something in the plastic bin in your refrigerator.
Sure.
It's the same thing with traditional foods. And the other thing is trying to find ways to recover that cold environment in a cellar or preserve it. And we have some very innovative engineers working at our organization. I know people are doing this in other places as well, but they're looking at very efficient strategies where you can supplement the cooling within an existing cellar and help monitor the conditions there and also help keep it cold.
And Heather, I would ask you to weigh in on this as well. This could potentially get to some of the concerns about mental health impacts when people have to abandon the cellars. I'm sure that they're not easy to build. When they have to abandon those, when they have to consider building new ones, that they may have to travel greater distances to reach. And then just the difference, as Michael talked about, between a traditional cellar and the effects on how the food is preserved versus a chest freezer. Talk a little bit about what you're seeing in that respect and the impacts to communities, how much harder it makes things.
When I was in Wainwright, we spoke with an elder who had an ice cellar that was in her family for generations, and it had recently been flooded from the water line breaking and flooding some of the cellars there. So I can tell that she was, you know, she lost a part of her ancestry there with the ice cellar not being there anymore and having to build another one. And I know in Point Hope, their ice cellar location is, they keep their ice cellars all in one location. And it's historical location. It's where they've always kept their ice cellars. And so, you know, just the discussion of having to move away from using whalebone structures and using something using wood instead of whalebone and then going to different locations, that has a whole other issue of how it impacts people moving away from their, you know, their ancestry in that part. But you know, I've noticed that they're building away from the coast more. There used to be a lot of ice settlers on the coast. Now they're more towards inland. But they're not yet, you know, drastically changing their traditional practices surrounding ice settler construction. They had to maintain them more, check on them more. But we're looking at an engineered design for ice settlers for the future.
Well, also another impact then, as you discussed, that people may have to look at more contemporary methods of food storage, then that brings in the element of electricity and having to pay for something that before the land provided for free. When you had an ice cellar, all you had to have was some building materials and no electrical hookup. So does that look like it will be a dramatic increase or maybe not for another generation? Is it just too hard to know?
Well, I guess one, you know, positive thing is that a lot of these changes are coming along, you know, along with some really great new technology. And so just like we're trying to find ways to make utilities more efficient and to use alternative energy in rural communities around Alaska, same thing with an ice cellar. And the toughest time for an ice cellar is the summer. And that's also when we have a lot of sunlight on the North Slope. So hopefully we'll be able to use some maybe solar-powered systems, but as an option to keep those prices down as far as the, you know, day-to-day operation of them.
Well, and that touches on another thing that was interesting to me. All of these reports seem to keep an eye out for positives that are happening on the ground in a changing climate. And I wasn't used to hearing climate change discussed in terms of positives, but I wonder if you can, one, explain why that's in the reports, and then two, what some of the specific changes that are positive are look like on the ground that you're seeing.
Well, I think, you know, one of the reasons, you know, that's in the report is it's just the nature of, you know, Heather and I both work on health impacts, and so we're used to looking at environmental change, other types of social change, and what it means for community health. And health is a topic that, you know, can straddle both the negative aspects and the positive aspects. It's harder to do that if you're looking just at the environmental issues sometimes, but with health you can. And so we're, you know, the end goal here is wellness. People who are community, broad community wellness. And so in some instances, climate change provides new opportunity. We have examples of lakes across the North Slope and across northern Alaska that are both shrinking and drying. You know, a lot of people don't realize that places like the North Slope Borough are very dry. It's really a desert, and if it was a state, it would be like Arizona. That's how much precipitation is received. The reason why the landscape is so wet is because of the permafrost keeping all of that water perched. So when we looked at water security and communities' ability to get adequate water, we've been paying close attention to what's happening with the permafrost. And as that previous image showed, some of these lakes are drying. It's because the permafrost is melting lower. The negative side of that is that you might lose a water resource. All of the communities up north depend on tundra lakes for their water supply, really. You might lose a water resource. The other negative part of it is that as it dries, it also warms up, and lots of things begin to grow in lakes as they warm up, and it makes it much harder to treat. So we have infrastructure that was built for a specific environment, but that environment is no longer present, and we have to know how to fix it, and we also have to know how to project what the environment will be like 20 or 30 years in the future so that we build something that is going to last and work well for a community. The positive side of it is that, you know, communities are rush, you know, from the time that the ice breaks to make enough water to fill the water tank. It's a summer job. And when you have a longer thaw season, that means more time to do maintenance. It also means more time to make water. It means a longer water-making season. So community water supply in the Arctic has both some negative and positive aspects from climate change.
Well, in our last minute here, I'd like to ask about the potential for policy impacts. Will these reports, do you think, our state, local, and federal officials looking at ways that maybe they can take this type of information, this sort of baseline of where communities are now, and look forward to how they may help with some kind of policy initiatives that can help in mitigation efforts? Are you seeing anything on the horizon in that respect, Michael? And I would also ask you, Heather, about North Slope borough officials.
Well, I think, from the statewide tribal health perspective, I mean, one thing that we've learned is we have to pay attention to what's happening in the environment. And it's important both for clinical staff, water operators, people who work on emergency preparedness. And so I see a lot more opportunity and a lot more action with collaboration between the wildlife community, the environment community, the public health community, and so there is lots of opportunities that are developing where people are working more closely together.
And Heather, very quickly, a comment maybe about North Slope borough officials and their thoughts on policy.
Sure, we're collecting new data and we're including climate change impacts in our oil and gas projects, and I understand so.
All right, thank you so much. Thanks, that's all the time we have. Thanks to my guests. And thank you for tuning in. We'll be back next week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.